Hello there, welcome to Beauty at Work. We are in between seasons at the moment, so please check out this clip from one of our episodes. Why does wonder matter? In this clip, Yale psychologist Dr. Frank Keel discusses the importance of facilitating wonder in education and why we shouldn't underestimate kids. Here's what he has to say.
Wonders have various senses over the years, and sometimes it's varied pretty close to awe, sometimes quite different. I see it as, I propose to use it as a much more active sense of really wanting to know what lies beneath, trying to find out, asking questions like why and how, what if. Awe can sometimes be seen as sort of standing back and going, oh, wow, isn't this beautiful? I'm almost kind of a more dumbstruck, passive mode. So I very much want to get the notion of engagement and question asking and exploration. And curiosity can be about facts. I think wonder is more about mechanism. Why does this work? Why is it this way? So if you're just curious about what the batting average of Ted Williams was, that's not so interesting to me. I want to know why he was able to do that. How come he could see the seams on the baseball and stuff like that?
That's great. So what attracted you to this topic? Why did you set out to write this book? Go ahead.
I think I was surprised to learn just how much whatever we can think of as question asking and wonder-like behavior seemed to crash when kids hit elementary school. You know, they're going up to asking sometimes wonder every few minutes in this fourth grader, four-year-old, sorry. And then they hit school, and some classic studies document that sometimes they will ask one or two why questions a day or none. It's as if it gets completely stifled. Now, I don't think it's on purpose. I don't think people are trying to do this. But what happens is a convergence of negative factors. Many teachers underestimate that children can understand deep abstract things and causal kind of arguments. So they just give them facts, but they don't want the facts. They want to know why those facts exist. The huge pressure in many countries towards standardized testing and assessments reinforces that fact-based kind of litany. The pressure on teachers with large classes to get results makes it very hard for them to have engaged discussions with kids. I talk at some length about the Finnish revolution in schooling, which resulted in a lot more kind of wonder kind of activity. So I think it's totally doable, but I was concerned about that. And then, you know, I noticed that there's some people who are lifelong wonders, who are just amazing. Richard Feynman is a wonderful example. Jennifer Doudna in the genetics area. These people, if you read their biographies, we just couldn't help but want to know how the world works from the moment they were born, practically, and they never stopped. The hunger was so strong. There's some wonderful cases in history. Thomas Young, this polymath back in the 18th century, who discovered everything from physics to music to life insurance. These incredible patterns. These people went on their deathbed. They just want to know more. They that's what they care about. Nothing else matters. So that's kind of why. And then my own self, I find just joy in learning about things. And I said, why is this so fun?
Yeah. Yeah. So was there anything you discovered as you were putting the book together that surprised you that you didn't expect?
A few things. One thing I'm actually working on more now is the sort of mechanism encroaching desert, I call it, the way in which the world is becoming less obvious to children, how it works. My 1963 Triumph Spitfire had zero transistors in it. It didn't have a radio. The comparable car today, like a Mazda Miata convertible, has something like 3 billion transistors. Everything's encased in blocks or silicon. You can't tell what the hell anything works. You talk to undergraduates, they have no idea. Now, they might say they know code instead, but they don't really know code. They know how to use it. So I worry that the most revealing, interesting things about how things work in the world are disappearing a bit. And I'm trying to get a better handle on that. So that surprised me. I was surprised at how wonder is so powerful in young kids. I had not realized how much it spurts before any schooling starts and how it surges. And then I was really surprised at how it gets shut down.
Right. Yeah. I'd love to follow up on a couple of those things as we go through along. I mean, so let's talk about I guess one of the core things that you argue here is that what we're wondering about fundamentally is causal mechanisms, right? That really is what children, as well as scientists, the scientists we talk to, we find that just across the countries that we studied, you know, it was some 70%+ of scientists, for them, what they find beautiful about science is the ability to grasp the inner logic of systems or the hidden order behind the patterns they see. And that seems to be, from your work, it suggested that this is just a natural extension of what we're drawn to as children. What are causal mechanisms, I suppose, and what draws us to them as children?
Well, we were surprised, because we've done some work in our own lab, on just how driven kids are to understand mechanisms. If you do a magic trick to a young kid, they want to crawl behind and take apart the device and figure out how the hell you did that. They like mechanisms more than facts. We've done a lot of studies showing this. They just really want to know why and how. The reason why they do that, it gets a much better payoff. It gives them more inductive power. If you know something about mechanism, you're more likely to figure out what else has the same mechanism. So it's a much more powerful insight. They prefer experts who know mechanisms over experts who know facts. This is before they go to school. So they've learned this is a very powerful tool towards figuring out what the world is like. I don't know if they like all mechanisms. I think they like the ones that are like clockworks, the ones that look kind of, they can almost visualize. And I think that maybe because we're sitting on top of a spatial system that's very evolutionarily old. So I like to see things laid out kind of spatially. Interesting question about this when we get into sciences is some people in areas of physics think there's no such thing as cause in the basic physics. It's just equations. Bertrand Russell once argued that, although he changed his mind later. And so I like to think it's very hard to think without cause. I think we really like to see things having effects and cascading downwards and looking at the branching architecture, if that's what it is, the cascade.
Right. Yeah. So what are the factors then that you found that facilitate this sense of wonder, this sense of drive to understand causal mechanism?
Well, to help it, if you're a parent or a teacher or just an adult, is to listen to the kids and ask them open-ended questions. Do not ask them how many X, Y. Ask them, wonder how this works, or wonder, what if we did this? Or what do you think this would be? Get them to think and generate longer responses. If you say, how many legs does it have? Versus, wonder why spiders have this many legs and other animals don't. You know, why are five digits so common across so many different vertebrates? These are the questions that work. But asking simply to report back facts or just say how cute that is, that doesn't get them engaged. So open-ended conversations and actually relating to your sharing a partnership with them. All of us have enormous gaps of ignorance. And the more you wonder, the more you realize how little you know. And so when you're talking to a kid, you're not stuffing knowledge in their head. You're sharing inquiry with them. You're not the same status. You know more than they do about a lot of things, but you're both wondering together. And I think that's very important. When I interact with my granddaughter, I always like to disclose my ignorance and say, I don't know, let's figure this out. And I think that's very important for them to realize that everyone's in the same boat, though. It's the same enterprise.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how much do you think the sort of repression of wonder is a result of our particular school system, right? I think of people like Ken Robinson, who've argued that really our schooling model is largely designed to create, foot soldiers for the Industrial Revolution. We want sort of compliant workers.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's, I know that argument and sort of the sort of corporate tech school assembly line models. I don't know if that's all that's going on. I think there's some pretty liberal principals and teachers who wouldn't endorse that at all. But I think they still fall into the same kind of trap, which is they're in a school where they have a lot of kids. They have these mandates to get certain kind of performances out of the kids. And those performances, despite all our national recommendations from panels that you want to look at causal beliefs and mechanism, the tests are almost always fact-based tests. And I document this in the book. The assessments they have to train these kids for are not the ones that they care about. And so, of course, it's going to get stifled. And the poor teacher doesn't have the time in a class to engage in a back-and-forth conversation, to crawl inside a kid's head and jointly co-wonder. They're supposed to just dump their knowledge into the kid. So, again, I don't think it's because they have this kind of a negative view of wonder. I think they just can't get it. They don't tell them the opportunity. And they underestimate how much kids can do this. We've done a lot of studies showing that when asked what they think kids can learn, they greatly underestimate it. We did one study where we showed kids a 7-minute video that is designed to teach adult technicians how to take apart and assemble and repair a diesel engine. And we asked teachers, could we show this to a kindergarten? Would they get anything out of it? And they said, of course not. It'd be stupid. They adored it, and they learned all sorts of abstract principles. And we had to do it certain ways. We had to make it work. But you can actually engage them in surprisingly abstract things. Even before they can speak, infants are, I'll tell you one study we did that got me engaged in a lot of this. Imagine you see a display of objects. Let's say it's a bunch of blocks all scattered around the table. A screen comes up, and a ball rolls behind the screen. The screen comes down, and the blocks are all neatly stacked. infants are very surprised at that. How can you create order out of disorder with just a ball? But if the other thing happens, if it goes from an ordered array to a disordered array, they're totally okay with that. And through a whole bunch of studies, we've shown that they know before they can even speak that only intentional agents, goal-directed agents, can create order out of disorder. And it's like entropy understanding. Now, how they get this, we're still trying to figure that out. It's now been replicated in several labs, so we know it's real. But that's very abstract, hard for even adults to articulate, but present well before they can speak. And so that kind of orientation and abilities, then we need to recognize more on them and nurture it.
Yeah, and it seems to fly in the face of a lot of common wisdom around privileging concrete versus abstract learning among young children. Right?
That's a myth. There's a lot of reasons people believe that kids go from concrete to abstract, but there's no good evidence for it. If anything, they're more abstract than they are concrete because they can't master all the details. You need to go to medical school to know all the disease and all the germs and all the microbes. But some of the broad principles of healing and curing can be mastered much younger.
Yeah, it's been such a fascinating read. I mean, I think of moments in my own schooling where I think I was really incentivized to memorize stuff. And, you know, I think I did very well in science as a student, but it was largely just sort of regurgitating facts and formulas and so on. And I think, you know, you win prizes for those things, and then it becomes a self-reinforcing incentive system. And so when I came across a physics and math teacher who actually was sort of a model for the kind of wonder-fueled science that I see among many scientists now that I'm studying, I just found him to be a crackpot. I thought, this guy is very strange. He seems to see mechanisms that you know, drive everything. And we'd watch a movie and he would want to explain, you know, why this particular thing moves in this way and seem to have this love for seeing those patterns and processes.
I mean, there's a tricky part to this, which is kind of like Richard Dawkins once talked about learning to play the violin. And why it's kind of painful at first, but you get this great output at the end. It's good to memorize some things because they give you a platform to think with. If you don't memorize your timetables and your addition tables, you don't get to see the structure of math that lies beneath. You don't get to see how math is all about structure. It's not about doing processes. There's this incredibly rich architecture, and you can't see it if you're just if you have no sense of how the numbers lay out, and that means having to memorize some stuff. So I hate just memorization, but I don't think we want to have kids think that you need to get to some slogging to get to see the good stuff. And so the great teacher sort of makes that clear. Let's play this game. Let's get this in. Do it kind of not painfully. But once you get those facts in place, then you start to see how interestingly it is to have that. If you don't have some shared knowledge base, it's much harder to engage in productive discovery.
Right. So adequate description seems really important too, right? Not just sort of looking for explanation, but also laying out here's how things are structured and ordered. And
but not too much detail. Again, there's always a question of digestible chunks. You don't want to overwhelm them. You want to give them enough to give something to pivot on, something to use as a platform. Not too much, because you can always revisit it.
Right. So one of the things I want to talk about, obstacles to wonder, again, among the scientists that we're studying, and one of the things that keeps coming up is stories of scientists who started out their PhD programs really fueled by wonder, really wanting to know how certain things worked, and then get caught up in this, you know, as they certainly climb the career ladder, get caught up in the pursuit of you know, chasing after grants and the publish or perish pressure that they're facing. And we hear from people that scientists today have much less agency and autonomy in pursuing the kinds of projects that you know, at the postdoc level than they used to 50 years ago. And we have scientists telling us that the sense of wonder that I had when I started has been beaten out of me by the pressures of the system.
It's a big issue. It's also sadly not equally distributed. If you're a faculty member at most medical schools, you all your salary comes off grants. So that means you cannot even afford to feed yourself unless you're getting grants. Now, the grants aren't always available in your area of interest. They might be in some topic that's very applied and not really what you care about, but you got to keep turning those grants through, usually two or three. I've heard of schools where the lab walls are literally on wheels, and as your grant income starts shrinking, the walls start shrinking in and going to other people. You know, that's very bad. But even in places where you have a full-time salary, like I fortunately have had, the pressure is ramping up ever more to look at your productivity and developing a portfolio of publications. And the conservative approach is to work in one topic and really get deep into it. Don't take too many risks. And I think that's unfortunate because the excitement is taking a risk, trying something crazy and finding it works and being willing to fail. And that's very high stakes today. One of the things that's happened is, I think we talked earlier, everything is metricized now. You can look up, when I started out, I had no idea how I was doing. I just was pursuing ideas. But now you can look up and see how many people are citing you. You know, there are these various scores of how productive you are. Everything is out there. It has a very different flavor. One of the scary things I've learned also, which I think de-incentivizes, is you're expected as a young investigator to market yourself. I heard a story recently which blew me away about a very hotshot molecular biologist who was being recruited by a number of schools. And some of the places asked him, so how are you managing your public portfolio? How are you doing your Twitter releases? How are you doing your Instagrams? Because we know that's important. I do the skills there to really rock up to the front. And I thought, that's the last thing you want. I mean, I don't like that because I feel like, how would I know that my stuff is really having an impact because of the science or because I'm a good PR specialist? And I think that is corrupting as well.
No, this is a really serious issue. I wonder, I mean, in your own lab, have you found ways to help your team sustain their sense of wonder in the face of these pressures?
I wouldn't say I do it perfectly, but one of the things I think is very important to me is that my students have ownership over a project. So I virtually never say, do study 3A in my grant. I have a research assistant who's paid to do that. And even those, I try to get some ownership feeling. So I often say, what do you care about? What do you like? And we brainstorm. And if I say, I don't resonate with any of this, then maybe I suggest they work with someone else in that project. But I'm ridiculously ADHD, so I'll pick up an interest in almost anything. In fact, I rarely publish more than 5 to 10 papers on a topic because I just get so bored. So I welcome new ideas all the time. And I tell them, I want you to become better at this and know more about this than I do soon. I want you to own it. And I think that's very motivating. And we try to do our live meetings by always asking, why should we care about this? Why is this interesting? Why does it matter? Not because someone else published something, we have to replicate it. That's the last reason I want to do it. Sometimes you have to do that to get started, but that shouldn't be the primary motivation. You should say, this is just plain interesting. There's a hole here, and it needs to be filled because without it, we can't really tell the right story, the full story.
Well, this is, I mean, it leads me to think about the relationship between wonder and something like humility, which seems really important for the current, you know, challenges in science, like the replication crisis, and again, the pressure to overinflate your claims and so on in order to get funding.
I did some work with Templeton Foundation, which relates into humility and lots of humility. I think there's different brands. I don't think you want the emotional humility that means you're intimidated. You're not willing to be daring and bold. But at the same time as being daring and bold, you have to admit your ignorance, admit that others might know more than you. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't speak up. I've been in groups where the younger career people don't dare speak out for fear that they might get screamed or it's not appropriate. I want to hear what they think. So I think humility is so important in terms of recognizing that you might be wrong or be woefully ignorant or there are experts you need to speak to. But it's equally bad to be humble if it's paralyzing. If it means I'm just not good at this stuff, it's hopeless, I can't understand it. I should just be subservient and let the big guns tell me what to do. You should always be willing to try out your ideas and see what they think of them. So I think there's a true wonder, in my sense, has a boldness to it, an adventurousness to it, while still realizing that you might be incredibly fallible and wrong.
Do you find that any qualities are required in order to persevere in the face of failures, in the face of being wrong? And because it could be incredibly discouraging for a lot of people to pursue a line of inquiry when success isn't forthcoming.
I don't study individual differences much, so I don't know that for sure. But I do think there's a pretty good literature suggesting if you focus on extrinsic factors as opposed to intrinsic factors, this goes back 50 years. So I want the fame of being a big professor or the big salary, forget that. But if I want some of these big kind of external factors to do this, you almost always be unhappy. But I said, I want to satisfy my urge to know why. I love unfolding this kind of structure that's going here. It's so cool to share in the thrill of discovery and kind of high-five, we just figured this out. So to focus on those factors is important. And some people need a little guidance to see that's what really matters. Unfortunately, a few people want to go into research and academia because they love the idea of the prestige. That's the last reason you want to go.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.